This fall, fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at MinkyCouture.com.
This is a True Crime in Real Time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
You know, for months, we've been told that law enforcement had their eyes on Brian Koberger from the start, that they built their case the old-fashioned way, tracking his car, pinging his phone, and stumbling onto a crucial DNA match from a knife sheath left behind at the crime scene. Turns out, that wasn't the whole story. We now know that the real key to unlocking the case against Koberger wasn't a routine police search. It was something far more advanced, far more controversial, and, until now, hidden behind sealed courtroom doors. Investigative genetic genealogy, a technique that law enforcement has been using to crack some of the most infamous cold cases of our time. It's how they caught the Golden State Killer. It's how they solved decades-old mysteries. And in the case of the Idaho 4 murders, it wasn't just a small piece of the puzzle. It was the very first moment Koberger's name entered the picture. And that right there is a game changer. Because for the first time, thanks to an unsealed court transcript, we now know that before law enforcement had a suspect, before they even knew where to look, it was an FBI genealogy search that handed them Brian Koberger's name. And that detail, it wasn't in the original probable cause affidavit. It wasn't shared in any press conference. It was kept under wraps. Until now. So let's break it down. Back in November 2022, when four University of Idaho students were brutally murdered in their off-campus home, investigators were left scrambling. There was no obvious suspect, no murder weapon, no forced entry. But there was one thing, one single piece of forensic evidence that they found at the scene. A Kabar knife sheath left behind on the bed next to one of the victims. And on that sheath, they found a tiny trace of DNA. Not a full profile, just a single-source male sample on the button snap. Not exactly a smoking gun, but it was something. The problem? When they ran that DNA through CODIS, the FBI's massive criminal DNA database, it came back with zero matches. Whoever left it behind had never been arrested or convicted of a crime serious enough to get their DNA entered into the system. So investigators were at a dead end. That's when they turned to investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG for short. Now, if you're not familiar with IGG, here's the deal. It's different from traditional forensic DNA searches because it doesn't rely on criminal databases like CODIS. Instead, it works kind of like those ancestry websites. 23andMe, Ancestry DNA, all that. When you send in your DNA to learn about your heritage, it gets uploaded into a private database. Law enforcement has access to some of those databases, but only the ones where users opt in to help solve crimes. And that's where things get murky, because according to the unsealed transcript, when the FBI ran Koberger's DNA through their IGG search, they didn't just get a match, they got 20,000 matches. That's a lot. More than they were supposed to get. According to a defense expert, the number of matches they received suggests that the FBI might have tapped into databases they weren't legally allowed to use. See, most police-approved databases, like GED Match Pro, usually return far fewer matches. So where did all these extra hits come from? Did they dip into a private database without permission? Did they overstep? The prosecution says no. They argue that this was just another investigative tool, another lead. No different from a tip phoned into a police hotline. But the defense? They see it differently. They see it as a potential Fourth Amendment violation, an illegal search, an invasion of genetic privacy, something that never should have been allowed in the first place. And they're not just making noise, they fought to have this evidence thrown out, but the judge, he wasn't having it. In his ruling, he made it clear the IGG search was legal. Law enforcement didn't arrest Koberger based on IGG results alone. They simply used the information to find his name and then built their case through traditional methods. In other words, the judge saw IGG as a starting point, not the finish line. And that means, for better or worse, this DNA evidence will be part of the trial. But here's where it gets even more interesting, because now we also know how law enforcement zeroed in on Koberger once they had his name. And it wasn't just a matter of pulling up an address and knocking on the door. The unsealed transcript reveals that investigators identified four male relatives through the genealogy search, four brothers, and they reached out to them trying to get more information. One of those relatives was immediately suspicious. He didn't believe the detective was real. At first, he responded to the investigators' messages, but when they started asking more questions, he cut them off, stopped responding, refused to cooperate. That's when law enforcement doubled down on Brian Koberger. They started tracking his car movements. They started pinging his phone. They followed him from Idaho to Washington and then across the country to Pennsylvania. And that's when they got their final confirmation. While Koberger was home in Pennsylvania for winter break, undercover agents raided his parents' trash. And from that trash, they pulled DNA from his father. That DNA was a parental match to the DNA on the knife sheath. Meaning, whoever left that DNA at the crime scene was almost certainly the son of the man who had just thrown out his garbage. And that's when police moved in and arrested Brian Koberger. But here's the thing. None of that would have happened if it weren't for the IgG search. Without it, his name wouldn't have surfaced. His car wouldn't have been flagged. His phone wouldn't have been tracked. So the question now becomes, how much weight does this DNA evidence really hold? The prosecution will argue that it's airtight, that this was a careful, methodical investigation backed by hard science. The defense? They're taking another route. They're bringing in an expert DNA attorney, someone with a history of challenging forensic evidence, someone who could dismantle the state's entire case. And if they're successful, it could shake the foundation of everything prosecutors thought they had. Because if the DNA is in doubt, what else is? If there's one thing you should know about the Koberger defense team, it's that they're not wasting their time trying to prove an alibi. They're not introducing alternative suspects. They're not even fighting the idea that the DNA found on the knife sheath is Koberger's. Instead, they've decided to attack the science itself, the methods, the procedures, the reliability of forensic DNA. And to do that, they've brought in one of the most experienced DNA-focused attorneys in the country, Bicca Barlow. Now, Barlow isn't just any lawyer. She's not some standard criminal defense attorney with a few forensic cases under her belt. She's a geneticist turned lawyer, someone who doesn't just argue about DNA in court, she actually understands how the science works. She holds a degree in genetics from UC Berkeley and a master's in genetics and developmental biology from Cornell. So, before she ever set foot in a courtroom, she was already trained in the very science that's at the heart of this case. Then she got her law degree and built an entire career around challenging forensic evidence, particularly DNA. And when I say she's challenged it, I mean she's led the charge against the way forensic DNA is used in courtrooms across the country. She was involved in one of the first successful challenges to STR DNA analysis, the same method used to match Koberger's DNA to the knife sheath. She's also gone after YSTR testing, mitochondrial DNA comparisons, and probabilistic genotyping models. Basically, every cutting-edge forensic tool prosecutors love to use. In short, this is not a lawyer you hire if you think your client is being framed. This is a lawyer you hire if you want to tear forensic DNA apart from the inside out. So why does this matter? Because by bringing in Barlow, the defense is telling us exactly how they plan to fight this case. They're not going to argue that the police have the wrong guy. They're going to argue that the science itself is flawed, that the way law enforcement obtained, processed, and analyzed the DNA evidence is unreliable. This move completely changes the stakes of the trial. For months, the prosecution has been leaning on the idea that DNA is irrefutable proof, that science doesn't lie, that the genetic match is the strongest link between Koberger and the crime scene. But now? Now the defense is weaponizing that same science against them. They're going to go after the lab procedures, the contamination risks, the statistical probabilities of DNA matches. They're going to argue that IgG overstepped its legal boundaries and that the way Koberger's name even ended up in this case was a potential violation of his constitutional rights. And here's where things get even more interesting. To make room for Barlow, Koberger's legal team pushed out another attorney, one who was already handling the forensic challenges. Jay Logsdon, a public defender who had been co-counsel on the case from the start, stepped back from trial duties and is now only involved as a consultant. That means Barlow isn't just an extra set of hands. She's the new lead on DNA-related issues. Logsdon had been the one filing motions challenging the IGG process, but now, with Barlow stepping in, it's clear that Koberger's team wanted someone with more specialized firepower. They're putting all their weight behind DNA challenges, betting that if they can undermine the forensic evidence, they can create enough reasonable doubt to avoid a conviction. And let's be honest, this isn't a bad strategy. Because as solid as the DNA match seems, it's not without its weak points. First, let's talk about what's actually missing from this case. The DNA from the knife sheath? It's a single-source male sample. That means it comes from just one person. No mixed DNA. No evidence of a struggle. No sign that the killer had blood or tissue from the victims on them. If Koberger was the one who committed these murders, and if they were as brutal as the crime scene suggests, shouldn't there be more than just a clean, isolated touch of his DNA on a snap button? And that's exactly the kind of question Barlow is going to hammer in court. The defense might argue that DNA transfer is possible, that Koberger's DNA could have ended up on that sheath through indirect means. Maybe it was handled by multiple people. Maybe contamination in the lab skewed the results. Maybe statistical analysis overestimated the probability of a perfect match. And that last part? That's huge, because DNA isn't just a yes or no result. It's a probability game. When analysts say, this DNA matches Koberger, what they're really saying is, this DNA is a match to Koberger within a certain probability threshold. And those thresholds vary depending on the methods used. Barlow has fought cases where those thresholds were miscalculated, where forensic analysts presented DNA as 99.99% certain, only for later reviews to show that the real probability of a match was far lower. And if the jury doesn't fully understand how forensic DNA works, that could be enough to shake their confidence in the evidence. Which brings us to the real risk for the prosecution, jury confusion. DNA evidence is complicated. It involves technical language, probability models, and forensic methodology that most people don't fully understand. The defense is going to use that complexity to their advantage. They're going to throw out terms like allelic dropout, touch DNA misinterpretation, and false positive rates. They're going to challenge the reliability of forensic labs. They're going to introduce expert testimony that questions the very foundation of forensic DNA matching. And if they can confuse the jury enough, they don't need to prove Koberger's innocence. They just need to make the jury unsure. That's the beauty of this defense strategy. It doesn't have to convince everyone that Koberger didn't do it. It just has to convince one juror that the DNA isn't reliable enough to convict. And when you bring in someone like Barlow, someone with an entire career built on challenging the credibility of forensic science, you're betting that she can plant those seeds of doubt. So now the question is, can the prosecution simplify their case enough to keep the jury focused? Can they prove that this DNA isn't just one piece of the puzzle, but the defining piece? Because if the defense succeeds in muddying the waters, the entire foundation of the prosecution's case could start to crack. And that's when things get dangerous. Because DNA might be the strongest evidence they have, but if that evidence falls apart, what's left? By now, this case is more than just about Brian Koberger. It's about the process, the science, the law, the ethics of modern crime solving. And with every new revelation, the upcoming trial isn't just shaping up to be a legal battle over guilt or innocence. It's becoming a test case, one that could set a precedent for how forensic DNA and investigative genealogy are used in future prosecutions. The unsealing of the IGG hearing was a major moment, not just legally, but also for public perception. For months, people speculated about how law enforcement found Koberger in the first place, but the original court documents left that part out. The probable cause affidavit painted a picture of old-school detective work, surveillance, cell phone pings, car tracking. What wasn't disclosed was that the entire investigation started with a cutting-edge DNA search, one that raised serious privacy concerns. For the average person, the unsealing of this information might actually reinforce confidence in the case. It shows that law enforcement used every tool at their disposal, that they didn't just guess or cherry-pick a suspect. They followed the science, If anything, it might make some people wonder why this information wasn't shared earlier. If it was all legitimate, why the secrecy? But for privacy advocates, this case is now a warning sign. It's proof that law enforcement can and will use genealogy databases to track down suspects, even if those suspects never voluntarily submitted their DNA. That's the trade-off. On one hand, genetic genealogy has solved horrific crimes. On the other, it raises the question, who owns your DNA? Because if it's not you, it might be law enforcement. And while that debate will continue, one thing is clear. None of it stopped the judge from siding with the prosecution. Judge Hippler's rulings have been a series of wins for the state, shutting down nearly every attempt by the defense to suppress evidence. The DNA? Admissible. The IgG search? Allowed. The phone records, the digital footprints, the online search history? All in play. That's a massive advantage for prosecutors because it means they're coming into trial with all their weapons intact. And honestly, it couldn't have played out better for them. Because Koberger's behavior in the days before his arrest? It's the kind of thing prosecutors dream about. According to the newly unsealed documents, FBI agents were already watching him when he returned home to Pennsylvania. They had him under surveillance, quietly keeping track of his movements. And what they saw? Well, it didn't look great. Koberger, in the middle of the night, wearing surgical gloves, sneaking out to dump trash. Not in his own garbage can, but in his neighbor's. Not exactly the actions of a guy who thought he had nothing to worry about. And when law enforcement retrieved that trash, that's where they found the DNA from his father, the key piece that confirmed the genealogy search was on the right track. And it didn't stop there. During that same period, agents watched him meticulously clean his car, going through it with a level of attention that raised eyebrows. Remember, this was just weeks after the murders, before the public knew his name, before he was officially a suspect. If he had nothing to hide, why was he acting like someone trying to erase evidence? Now, to be fair, none of this proves guilt. But in the courtroom, prosecutors will use it to paint a compelling picture. They'll argue that Koberger was a man who knew the walls were closing in, that he was desperately trying to get rid of anything that could connect him to the crime. And that's what makes jury selection such a critical piece of this case. Because how do you find an impartial jury in a case like this? How do you find 12 people who haven't already made up their minds? The media coverage has been relentless. This case has been dissected on every true crime podcast, debated in every online forum, analyzed on every major news outlet. That's why the trial had to be moved from Lata County to Ada County, home to Boise, the largest city in Idaho. The pool of potential jurors is bigger, the chance of finding people without preconceptions slightly higher, but it's still going to be a challenge, and it's not just public opinion that the court is trying to control. Judge Hippler has kept the gag order firmly in place, making sure that neither side can try this case in the media before it gets to trial. No leaks, no public statements from the attorneys, no interviews with key witnesses. And while that might frustrate reporters, it's a move designed to protect the integrity of the trial, to prevent a circus, to ensure that when the case is argued, it's done inside the courtroom, not on social media. That said, the public will still get to watch, just not in the way some might have hoped. Unlike the Johnny Depp trial or the Murdaugh case, there won't be cameras streaming every second of the proceedings. Instead, the court is setting up a live feed in an overflow room, where members of the media and the public can follow along. It's a compromise, a way to maintain transparency while avoiding the spectacle of a televised trial. And make no mistake, this is going to be a long trial. Right now, it's set to begin in August 2025 and could last up to 15 weeks. That's almost 4 months of testimony, evidence, cross-examinations, expert witnesses. A trial of this length isn't just about presenting evidence. It's about building a narrative, about keeping the jury engaged, about making sure that after months of testimony, they still remember the key facts. And if Koberger is convicted, it won't just be a life sentence. He's facing the death penalty. That's what makes this case different from so many others. Because the stakes aren't just about whether he walks free or spends life in prison. The state is arguing that this crime was so heinous, so calculated, so brutal, that he deserves to die for it. And that changes everything. Because in death penalty cases, the defense has an entirely different burden. They're not just trying to introduce reasonable doubt, they're also trying to humanize their client, to convince at least one juror that even if he's guilty, he doesn't deserve to be executed. And when you bring in forensic battles, scientific debates, ethical questions about how police collect DNA, it becomes more than just a murder trial. It becomes a landmark case, one that could influence how genetic genealogy is used in the future, one that could reshape how forensic DNA is presented to juries, one that could determine whether or not prosecutors can rely on IgG evidence to convict someone of murder. So while the trial is about Brian Koberger, it's also about the future of forensic investigations. Because if this evidence holds up, if a jury is convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that IgG was used properly, that the DNA evidence is rock solid, that Koberger is guilty, then this case sets a precedent. But if the defense succeeds, if they convince just one juror that the science isn't as airtight as the prosecution claims, if they create enough uncertainty to avoid conviction, then suddenly everything changes. Because if DNA, the so-called gold standard of forensic evidence, can be challenged, if genealogy searches can be questioned, if forensic methods can be picked apart to the point where a jury hesitates, then it's not just Koberger's fate on the line, it's the future of every case that relies on DNA. And that's what makes this trial so much bigger than one man.
She was the perfect wife, always smiling, always supportive. A pillar of the community, beloved by friends, adored by family, and secretly researching undetectable poisons in her spare time. Maybe it was the way he chewed. Maybe she just got bored. Or maybe, just maybe, she had been planning this since the honeymoon. But if he had just paid attention, if he had just known what to look for, if he had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and learned the red flags, he could have heard every episode of Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Ad-free and before everyone else, he could have seen it coming. Instead, he's 6 feet under and she's shopping for husband number two. Don't be like him. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.